Kathy is our next case. Mr. Ravitz.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Ms. Jenkins. My name is Gary Ravitz, and it's my privilege today to address you for a few minutes on behalf of Byron Kathy. Byron was found guilty by a jury of conspiracy and aiding and abetting a drug distribution to a government informant. We moved post-trial for a judgment of acquittal or in the alternative for a motion for new trial. That motion was denied by the district judge. In this appeal, we are mindful that the jury's verdict is entitled to deference from this court, but at the same time, it's not sacrosanct, and we think that in this case that a reasonable jury could not have found Mr. Kathy guilty either of the conspiracy or, admittedly, the more difficult question in count two of aiding and abetting. But there is a related question as well that, assuming just for the sake of this argument that the court were to sustain the second count of aiding and abetting, we think the case should be remanded to the district judge for a resentencing hearing. Since it appears that the judge relied on the conspiracy count as the more serious count in imposing a sentence of 97 months in this case. Now, the glaring and unusual aspect of this case is that Kathy and the informant were on the same side of the deal. And that's a significant feature that is not present in the cases being relied upon by the government, specifically Herrera and Gilmer. It certainly isn't similar to the facts in Harris upon which the district judge relied in denying our motion. What happened essentially is that the informant, who was a drug dealer, got arrested the night before by the DEA. Being a smart guy, he realized he would cut his losses by offering the DEA someone to help him serve that sentence. And who he had in mind was a co-defendant, Doug Greer, someone he knew from the neighborhood, had grown up with, along with Byron Kathy, who he knew to be a drug seller. Now, everyone agrees that Byron had not been involved in the drug business previously. I think the government has conceded as much, and I think the informant testified that he had no knowledge that Byron was involved in the business before. But he needed Byron in order to reach Greer, and he reached out to Byron, who was a mutual friend, and Byron made calls on behalf of the informant and eventually tagged along with the deal that was consummated on the south side of Chicago.
You know, Mr. Ravitz, as you point out so well, as you always do, Mr. Kathy was principally trying to assist Mr. Jones. But he did more than bring Mr. Jones to Mr. Greer and then walk away. He helped negotiate the terms of the sale, set up meetings between Jones and Greer. He calmed Jones down while they waited for Greer to show up with the cocaine. You know, he was a psychiatrist. And the broker's fee that Jones was going to pay him gave Mr. Kathy a stake in the transaction. So why don't we have enough?
Judge, here's what I would say. I don't think that Byron shared the principal's intent in this case. I think he certainly was working with the informant. But for aiding and abetting, the government had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Byron shared Greer's intent. And here you've got this unusual fact where Byron takes off before the deal's consummated. He doesn't even wait around to witness the completion of this deal, which, you know, presumably would trigger the payment of money by Jones to Byron in this case. So I think that is an unusual fact. Now, look, there's one fact that we fronted in our opening brief, which is that Byron called Greer on the phone. And that is certainly a troubling fact, and I suppose under this court's decisions, arguably is enough to make him liable under an aiding and abetting theory. But it's balanced in some measure here by the fact that Byron was, I think, aligned with Jones in this case, that Byron was somewhat naive and inexperienced in these things, and he was being used on both sides. He's being used by Jones to get to Greer, and Greer is also using Byron in the sense that he has Byron making phone calls and talking. He, you know,
Greer doesn't want. If you're used by both sides, then you're a conspirator.
Well, I mean, used in the sense that he was abused by both sides in this case, Judge. I don't think that Byron.
Well, he's not unconscious, right? He's
well, you know, let me just say this. Byron, looking back on the events after this trial, was able to see where a jury could have determined, based on the evidence it heard, that he had conspired. But I will tell you that he always felt, and I think the reason he went to trial in this case, and the reason he didn't raise an entrapment defense in this case, was because he actually didn't feel that, he felt that he was more of an observer than a participant in these events. And as far as the conspiracy is concerned here, what you have is a single transaction occurring on a single day with a single buy in this case. There's no prolonged activity on Byron's behalf. There's no course of selling or buying that's in this record. And so for purposes of conspiracy, I think you don't have factors present in this case, which this court has relied on in numerous cases in finding a conspiracy existed. So I respectfully would disagree with the court's analysis of Byron's a conspirator in this case. If he was, he was a conspirator, as we pointed out in the trial court, with the informant. And so that really is the basis for attacking the conviction in count one of this case. If the court doesn't have further questions, I'll pass the torch on to Ms. Lindsay. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the court. The district court properly instructed the jury as to the conspiracy count. The instructions provided that the defendant's unlawful agreement could not be with the informant in this case, and that the defendant's co-conspirator, in essence, could not be the informant. This instruction, in effect, informed the jury that if it concluded that the government's evidence had only shown that the defendant had agreed with the informant, then it, in essence, should find the defendant not guilty of the conspiracy. Of course, the jury's verdict was guilty as to count one, and coupled with that instruction, the court should reject the defendant's argument.
Ms. Jenkins, do you think this is a close case, a close call?
Frankly, no. I think that...
Spoken like a true prosecutor.
I think that Mr. Cathy did quite a bit to show that he was truly invested and had a shared stake in the successful distribution. As Your Honor pointed out, Mr. Cathy did not make a single telephone call and then place Mr. Greer in touch with the informant. He had several telephone calls with both parties. He was negotiating his own fee. He was negotiating the total purchase price. He attended not one but two meetings. And as the district court pointed out, calmed a seemingly agitated Tommy Jones.
But he was really Jones's representative and advocate in this transaction, right?
In a sense, yes. Much of what he did was advocating for the price that Mr. Jones was trying to achieve.
Right. Jones is his friend. Jones is the one who would be paying him the broker fee. But, of course, Jones is the informant, so he can't be convicted of conspiring with him.
Correct. But he was also doing
this. In what sense was he aiding Greer's side of the transaction and thus conspiring with Greer? He can't be conspiring with Jones.
Correct.
It has to be with Greer. So what's he doing for Greer?
I think, in essence, because there's a negotiation and back and forth on the price, he's essentially doing advocating on both sides, like any broker in most circumstances would do. He's conveying to Mr. Jones, the informant, what Mr. Greer's price is, why it is that Mr. Greer will not reduce the price, and essentially because the parties can't reach an agreement, Mr. Cathy takes it upon himself to arrange for this meeting, the first meeting at a Walgreens, so that the supplier and the buyer can meet face-to-face and hash out the details. Of course, Mr. Cathy's role in terms of his assistance of Mr. Greer is highlighted at the very last meeting because Mr. Greer is late in showing up with the cocaine, and he's making sure on behalf of Mr. Greer that the buyer doesn't leave, doesn't get impatient, doesn't take off. He's coming. I just spoke to him. He's on his way. Thanks again for making sure that the fees and price was fair.
So is this a case of no good deed goes unpunished?
There's certainly an element of that to this case. I think even as defense counsel stated, you know, the problem here is that Mr. Cathy went too far. He didn't just put two people in touch with each other and back away. He was invested in every step, as evidenced by his presence and his words in the recording.
It's a first time, isn't it?
Certainly. Just one brief mention on with regard to count two in the aiding and abetting. As the court is aware, both count one and count two are based on the same drug type, same drug quantity, the same seven kilograms. The district court properly sentenced defendant to 97 months imprisonment on both counts to run concurrent. So to the extent that any modification were necessary on the conspiracy count, although the government, for the reasons stated, does not believe that's the case, any modification could be accomplished by this court without a remand. So unless there are any further questions, the government rests on its brief. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Ms. Jenkins. Anything further, Mr. Ravitz?
With respect to the question that you asked, Judge Roepner, at the sentencing hearing, the government, I think, pointed out accurately that there was no evidence that Byron previously had been involved in drug trafficking, but the prosecutor argued, however, at age 47, he should know better. And I really think that this was an exercise of very bad judgment on Byron's part. I mean, and more than bad judgments required to sustain convictions. We don't send people to prison because they exercise bad judgment. We send them there because they have an intent to commit an offense. As to the point that Ms. Jenkins made with respect to the need for a resentencing hearing, I guess all I would say is that this court very recently has pointed out that it's a very small price to pay to send the case back for a brief resentencing hearing where there may be a question that the sentence was based on a conviction that can't stand, and namely, in this case, a conspiracy conviction in count one. So I do think, contrary to the government, that a remand at a minimum for resentencing is necessary. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. And Mr. Ravitz, we appreciate your willingness to accept the appointment in this case. The case is taken under advisement.